Welcome to A World of Fragile Truths, a podcast where we unpack the latest evidence for security and rule of law, which show the assumptions under the sector's work are often fragile. I'm Christian Kuitert from the knowledge platform Security and Rule of Law, and today's latest evidence comes from my guest Victoria Budde from the Institute für Friedensforschung und Sicherheitspolitik, IFSH. Together with the Bergo Foundation, her recent paper discusses trust-building interventions in the security sector and trust within those partnerships as well. The other colleague at this digital table is Ines Abdelrazek from the NGO Palestine Institute for Public Diplomacy, bringing in her experiences from a context where many ineffective trust-building interventions took place for decades. And we're off. Hi, Ines, Victoria.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hello, nice to be
Welcome.
With you.
Welcome. For our listeners, to introduce you a bit, Victoria, you wrote this paper, which this can be found in the description. Did you work on similar topics before, or could you summarize your career path very shortly for our listeners?
Yes, of course. First of all, a little add-on. I did not write that paper on my own. I did it together with my colleague, Caroline Eickhoff, who was then a researcher at the Bergo Foundation, as you already mentioned.
Credits where credits due.
Exactly. I have been working as an advisor at the German Ministry of Foreign Affairs, first on rule of law promotion and then security sector reform. I have especially worked project-based, so I tried to, or I gave advice to the Foreign Office regarding the especially project design in rule of law promotion and security sector reform.
And Ines, can you also get us up to speed with your work in Palestine throughout the years?
Yes. Well, actually, before I was in Palestine, I also worked on, aid policies and advising on development cooperation. But I think I got tired, but also thought like change would not come from there. So I'm now really focusing on campaigning and advocacy in civil society in Palestine. So I'm based in Jerusalem, and we really or an independent NGO trying to promote Palestinian rights through a lot of partnerships also with other civil society organizations in Europe.
Right. Then back to the paper, Victoria. Why does a science-oriented woman like you research such a subjective and ambiguous topic like trust? What do security and rule of law professionals need to know about
that
this?
Is the beauty of it all, that we try to make it as least or as little subjective as possible, because we have out there, both in policy strategies but also in project documentation, a lot of claims that trust is going to be built as a consequence of a project, as a consequence of a strategy. But when my research partner Caroline and I started out that research project, we said, okay, we hear talk about trust a lot, but what do they actually mean when they want to build trust? How do policymakers assume that trust is built as a consequence of their interventions? Or we talked to policymakers in order to find out what they actually were trying to achieve concretely.
And what are your associations with the concept of trust within the context of today's Palestine, Ines?
Well, there has been a lot of international donors and international actors, but specifically Western actors who are heavily involved here diplomatically, who have promoted a lot of these trust building projects that have indeed been evaluated as fairly unsuccessful, but it still drives a lot of funding to the country. And I think it has also increasingly been criticized by Palestinians. And so we're in this moment where basically these projects are being pushed by, I think, the Western actors, but are increasingly rejected.
So you mentioned, Victoria, there's a lot of assumptions being done, and Ines, that maybe those are not always right because there's a lot of unsuccessful projects. So what are then the key messages in your paper then, Victoria?
One of the major takeaways we had after isolating two basic trust-building strategies, one was people who are in contact more, trust each other more. The second strategy was people who perceive service delivery by security actors as efficient trust these security actors more. We basically started our research report with that we needed to check these strategies against research findings. So what we found out is that power and especially asymmetric relationships is something that is really under-reflected in the strategies. We have seen that our assumptions regarding how trust between civilians and the state works rely a lot on studies that have been done in the global north, so like the US or Germany. And but the contexts where trust building is actually applied are contexts where the citizen-state relationship is partly completely different. Second, we would like to point out that the contact hypothesis we have seen feature very centrally in policymaker strategies is something that should be reviewed in certain contexts as well. Apparently, trust doesn't work as easily as people who are in contact trust each other more. So it's much more complicated than that. And the last one I would like to point out is alternatives to trust. So trust, you know, is a very demanding mechanism between groups of people. So our question would be, do we always have to start at an integration level that is so deep as trust is in order to achieve reliable negotiation outcomes?
Ah, so indeed those assumptions were not right. Maybe help me picture it a bit more then, Ines. What have those trust interventions looked like in Palestine?
Yes, I think I've read with interest the paper because it touched upon a lot of the issues that I think makes Palestine a case in point. In Palestine, you know, between Israelis and Palestinians, we're talking unequal rights. We're talking very dire asymmetry of power and preventing a people from exercising their right to self-determination. And so when to that you apply that framework, you distort that reality and you actually perpetuate the problem instead of solving it. And this is what we have witnessed since basically the starting of the Middle East peace process that started basically transforming what has been a global issue, a regional issue for the Palestinian people quest for national liberation and self-determination into a bilateral issue, something that has been transformed into a bilateral issue with the U.S. as honest broker or as pretended broker and trying to have the two parties negotiate. And so today we're in this where clearly we have tried all these projects and they have failed because they have maintained the status quo. And worse, I think they have, you know, enabled Israel as the one who has the power, who has the sovereignty to avoid having to be held accountable.
So by not taking into account the asymmetry between the two to be trust-builded actors and also the willingness to actually then warrant that trust, let's say, that makes it an unsuccessful or maybe even counterproductive intervention. Is that something you've also seen in the other context that you have researched, Victoria?
I think Ines is making a really interesting point here because research basically fall back onto the Alport contact model, which has been designed for relations between individuals that can actually talk on eye level, basically. A very practical example of what these facilitations would look like. It could be a town hall meeting, for example. Let's say police officers are invited and the local community there actually should be policing. And so each side can utter their grievances, right? In the Alport model, these actors would actually have to have equal access to arms, so to speak, but that is literally not the case. Not only if you talk about Israeli security forces, but also if you talk about Palestinian security forces. So in none of these cases, actually, you have equality of arms, so to speak. And that is why we would like to point out that the contact hypothesis, especially in the context where you bring security actors and civilians together, it needs to be revisited.
Well, let's definitely reimagine that. But first, Ines, can you give us an idea of what does it look like for a person when trust in such institutions is not there?
Again, I think it's not a question of trust. There needs to be several assumptions and conditions so that the trust building framework can be applied. You have the people-to-people project, what we call people-to-people, which is basically bringing, let's say, civilians together around the table and have a dialogue. And this has been done a lot in the past decades. I was part of them when I was, you know, a kid. After Oslo agreements, you bring teenagers to meet each other, to understand their own reality. The problem is that clearly, on the one hand, you have Palestinians who went back to their very discriminatory reality, that they live under military occupation, under a system that treats them as unequal citizens, or sometimes as even not citizens at all, unequal human beings, you know. And the Israeli just was going back to his reality of domination, of just liberty, freedom, and not having to care about, I think, the, you know, the oppressed reality of the Palestinian. This has created even further divides. Actually, there has been some evaluations done. On the one hand, you have Israelis who completely forgot about those programs. And on the other hand, you have Palestinians who have increased grievances and anger about those programs, because it has nothing, you know, it has not changed or brought them just simply equal rights. So that's for the People to People project, which really have made Israelis feel good about themselves, that they believed in peace, etc. Well, the Palestinians really was felt tokenized and used into, you know, having to go around the table. Again, there will be a time for, I think, dialogue and trust building. But as we saw in the case of South Africa and others, you know, you have to have equal rights before.
So the timing is off. And
Christian, if I may, because you asked for an example of how a relationship would look like if, when there's no trust, right, between the security actors and civil societies. And I think Ines is making a really important point here when she says trust building may not only lead to nothing, but trust building actually can have detrimental effects, because Ines has pointed out that there are grievances, right? From a do no harm perspective, we see here that the engagement might not only be in vain, but may actually worsen the whole situation.
Yeah, no, the problem is clear. If the timing's wrong, if it's not a holistic approach, but actually only that narrow trust building approach, then yeah, it can be counterproductive. So let's take a quick break, and after that discuss, you know, what can be done about this, your recommendations, maybe where to go from here, when is the timing right also. But let's first pause here to hear from our listeners. They shared what they think are fragile truths in our security and rule of law sector.
When I think of a fragile truth, I think naturally of peace processes and reconciliation and reconstruction processes. And I think rebuilding a country after war, all of that is challenging and requires some consensus and some degree of a common truth. But this is also often obtained at the expense of a plurality and the diversity of voices. Similarly, in many contexts, peace agreements, very seldom do they encompass the perspectives of young people who constitute the majority of the population. Those truths carried by the peace agreements are then also very fragile.
So I believe one of the core assumptions is that there's a lot of issues in the global south that need to be solved. But I think where it really starts is looking at the issues that we still face in the global north, and not assuming that, you know, in the global north, like in the Netherlands, access to justice is sorted, because it's not. I think it would be really interesting to look at the best practices and the incredible knowledge and experience Global South countries have in reaching minorities, and to actually transport those to countries in the Global North.
Thank you for sharing your messages, much appreciated. And of course, I encourage every listener to contribute too by sending a short WhatsApp voice note to the telephone number in the description. So, Victoria, you talked to many policymakers. You did a lot of literature studies. So can you give us an idea of how it could work?
Well, one interesting finding was actually when we read more about management literature and organizational literature, which it was kind of surprising to us, because that is literature that we would normally maybe not consider as much from a peace building angle. And there we found that researchers much more openly engaged in situations where there's simply no trust, right? Where trust cannot be built as a mechanism that is governing negotiations, and still you need reliable outcomes. They suggested mechanisms that could be applied if you can't build trust, but you still need a reliable outcome. And one of these approaches would be the introduction of security mechanisms. For example, have a third party that you can introduce to the talks if both sides don't trust each other, but maybe both sides have reason to trust the third party, right? So that could be one mechanism that is already applied in peace building. If I would have to flag anything here, then I would say trust requires a lot of integration. Maybe let's take a step back and see what other mechanisms we can test apart from trust.
What does that look like? Is that a mediation, as Ines described, more on the bigger peace agreement level, or is that on very local community level?
So it of course depends a bit on the output that you're trying to achieve, right? If you're trying to achieve a major peace agreement, then I think this is the role where a third party has been considered most often and has been applied most often. But there is no reason why you would believe that it wouldn't work on lower levels, so to speak, on more direct levels. What I'm trying to advocate in favor of here is to try alternative approaches to trust building by, for example, engaging partners you would normally not engage with, or just simply to try something other than contact or efficiency.
So admit that there's no trust and work from there, maybe with a third party. How does that sound to you, Ines?
Yeah, the issue of third party is very interesting in our case. I mean, clearly the United States, you know, have played this, I think, a very biased, role. Clearly, we're looking at Israel, the U.S. as one of, Israel's closest ally. They give $3.8 billion in military aid to Israel. So clearly they were already from the onset not an honest broker, and they presented themselves as is in the peace negotiations. And I think this was, also what contributed to this being a harmful process. When we look at other contexts, the Dayton Accords or the post-apartheid South Africa, all of it came with very clearly rights and justice coming before you could even rebuild trust or build trust, which means that, South Africa, but also Serbia had been isolated. They had been, held accountable for having a regime or a set of rules that, treat people unequally and treat people with, in a set of very clear domination pattern. And I think this domination pattern is not only between Israelis and Palestinians. I've read recently a book about, women and men and basically domestic violence. And we're looking at, in some context, even in Europe, where women who've been beaten by their husbands still are proposed mediation processes, which is very harmful because you don't want to be in a mediation process with your oppressor. First needs to come justice and a realization of the one who dominates that they are doing things wrong, that they are ready to change. And then you can go into trust building. And so until there is, some form of accountability, which the UN has tried to play, right, by passing resolutions, by trying to be there in reminding Israel of its responsibility, or any states for that matter of their responsibility. That's why international law exists. But it's definitely been very undermined by this approach of trust building and peace building, because you're looking at then international being sidelined and for something that then is treated as a bilateral issue.
So within those asymmetric positions, what can you do from a position with fewer power?
As strategies like going after for civil boycotts, different types of, going to the International Criminal Court, trying to seek accountability elsewhere. I think Israelis, and they have NGOs that have been really working on that too, educate around what happened in 1948 and the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, history and what is happening now. And I also participated in another Initiative where you had like a lot of, I think it's American Jewish organization, and they bring Palestinians to speak to a Jewish audience and to some Israelis, but not in a on a table where you expected to have a dialogue with each other, but it's more for like the Israelis and the Jewish groups who are, you know, those who have more power, those who hold effectively, you know, the keys to change. To listen more to Palestinian voices. So I think this kind of initiative where the framing is not one where you are expected to solve your a grievance, but rather have the weaker part have their voice heard is very important, I think.
I hear, for example, one was the, what you mentioned, Victoria, admit there's no trust, the mediation factor. Ines, you say, you know, the timing question that we discussed before, the timing is right first if you address justice, basic justice and rights issues, and then only after that you can think about terms like trust building. Are there, in the discussions you had with policymakers, Victoria, other possible scenarios that you discussed?
Yes, I think Ines is, again, has made a very valid point here regarding that in power asymmetries, all sides have to be heard, right? And that is, of course, directly connected to resources. So if we're talking about peace building and projects, that, of course, means that resources will have to go in the direction to that is going to help bridge the power imbalance. And of course, it also includes the partners you choose as project partners, as implementers. Again, if we talk about trying out new partners, then that would, of course, also mean trying out not only the partners that you have, let's say, a decade-long history of project implementation with, or maybe the organizations that even stem from the donor countries. I would also like to argue in favor of using local knowledge, using or cooperating with organizations that actually are part of the communities where you're trying to build trust in.
I'm curious to hear examples. I'm trying to understand, you see, when I'm thinking of Israel, for example, as one that has the monopoly of power clearly over both Palestinian population and Israeli population, they don't act in good faith. The policies, practices, and laws consider this the Palestinian people as inferior. And so I was wondering if you actually only looked at fairly democratic system where, you know, citizens are equal, where they have equal rights.
So what we did do was talk to policymakers in Germany and in the Netherlands, and we asked them what their strategies were, right? Due to COVID-19, we had to cancel our field research, so we weren't lucky enough to do the field research ourselves. However, what we also did was to talk to project implementers, people on the ground who actually have first-hand experience in mediating dialogue projects between security actors and civilians. And we discussed our findings with these experts in order to find out more about the realities on the ground. And that is actually also where a large strand of our alternatives to trust, and let's be realistic about how much trust can actually be built, comes from.
So policymakers are the ones that need to learn most here, if I understand that correctly. Are there from those 50 pages, did we miss anything? This will be a good opportunity to voice that.
So what we did do was to not only find the strategies policymakers actually apply, but also knowledge gaps, right? So one of the major tasks of our research report was to find out what we do not know, but what we do need to find out about. And so what I would like to point out is that, and that's why I also think that Fragile Truths is a very good podcast for that, is we have a lot of assumptions regarding trust and trust building that may not stand on such a firm ground as we would think. And that's why a lot of these assumptions will have to be reconsidered. And for time reasons, I am going to refer you to the research report. We also have an executive summary, so maybe that helps bridging the 50 pages.
Thank you. That saves me work in editing. And Ines, what are you taking out of this conversation?
That I think, obviously, we come from very different contexts of both practice and research, you know, between Germany and or Netherlands and Israel and Palestine, there is a lot of difference. I would say, I think that for trust building, peace building, or reconciliation or mediation work to be positive, some conditions and I think some assumptions need to be there. And these conditions are not there in the case of Palestinian and Israelis. There needs to be, I think, equal rights and a fairly, you know, even if a slight asymmetry of power, but there has to be equal rights. And I think people have to be living under a similar set of rules and rights. And there needs to be structural change happening to address root causes when there is, again, you know, a set of rules of one dominating and one dominated, or one oppressed and one oppressor. I think these structural change need to happen in order to then go into this kind of dialogue that indeed we're definitely not there yet. And in the absence of that is actually harmful.
Yeah, thank you. I think we definitely tackled a fragile truth in this episode. So we'll stop here. There's plenty to be still said about it. But our listeners and I want to thank you for sharing your ideas on such a difficult topic. And for our listeners, of course, keep shaking those fragile truths. And who knows, we'll talk about it in a future episode. So I'll see you next month.